This is The Guardian.
I'm Jane Lee, coming to you from Wurundjeri land, and this is the full story. Have you ever made a big decision based on what your gut tells you? And did it turn out to be the right one? For over a decade, cognitive neuroscientist Professor Joel Pearson has been studying how the brain unconsciously processes information and past experiences to guide our actions. Now he's on a mission to help people better understand how to use this gut feeling, which he argues can improve your quality of life and even save it. So, how does it work? And when should you ignore it? Today, when should you trust your intuition? It's Monday, the 1st of April.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Joel, for your book, The Intuition Toolkit, you spoke to someone called John Muir. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Absolutely, yeah. So John is a classic character, and he's very famous in World of Expedition, mountain climbing, basically any field of exploration of extremes, he's sort of well known. But this story comes from the 1980s when climbing Everest was still a big deal. It wasn't like it is nowadays where, you know, there's film crews there every season and every expedition to the summit comes with safety officers, and high-tech GPS, everything. So this was, I think, was it 84? And he was, there was a small team going for a summit. And those days, it was a real build-up. And sort of, I talk about this in the book, you know, it was years in the making. And this kind of adds the pressure to for the final day, for that final push to the summit. So they'd camp the night, ready for that final push to the summit the next day. And they start in the dark and it's bleak, it's cold, and they're packing up their tents. And the sun rises and they're making their way sort of up the south face of the mountain. And they're about to hit the edge there where they're sort of the point of no return, as they call it, where the wind is blowing. And once they go past that point, they're kind of committed to making the journey to the top. Also, John's very famous for having what he says is an iron stomach, this ironclad stomach where he can, you know, from India to Thailand to wherever, he can eat anything from any road stall and he's fine. But on this particular day, he describes this sensation as they were heading, pushing up to the summit, as this sinking heavy feeling, dis-ease, as in a lack of ease in his stomach. And it just started getting stronger and stronger. And at first he thought it was a rumbling stomach or something to do with food, but then he realized it wasn't. And it was this heaviness pulling him down. And he started to have doubts about pushing to the summit, that it was perhaps too windy and they were too tired and these different things. And as they inched their way closer and closer to that point of no return, when the wind was howling up the mountain, he just got this feeling, it became stronger and stronger until he said, no, this is not right, we're not going to do it. And he called, he said, no, I'm going to turn around and make my way back to the camp. And people were shocked, you know, that they'd trained for years to this, they'd raised all the money, and he convinced two of the others to come back with him, but then another two said, no, don't be silly, we're going to go to the summit, we're going to make this thing. So the team split and two of the individuals kept going, and the rest turned around and started back climbing down the mountain. And then I think about 2 hours later, they were still climbing down and they heard noise, and they looked up and those two climbers came hurtling down and just missed them, almost took John out as they were sort of down climbing. So they'd fallen from the top and they unfortunately lost their lives. And he talks about this and many other sort of examples of him following his gut, him following his body's response to a situation where things just didn't feel right. And he'll stop climbing, he'll stop whatever he's doing and just stop for the day. And he says that his gut really has saved his life and his team's life in many situations. So it was just a poignant example of intuition in action, of somewhere, you know, extreme Everest, someone that's learned to follow this feeling and it saved lives.
I guess intuition is often written off as just some mystical, unknowable sensation as opposed to something that is actually observable. So is intuition something that all of us have, or is it just the John Muirs of the world?
It is something we all have, but we have it to different degrees. So in the data we've collected in my lab, that we see these quite extreme differences, individual differences, as it's called, whether we test people in our, you know, lab-based objective measure or we give them a questionnaire, we see differences. Some people say, I use intuition every day for a lot of my decisions. Other people say, no, not at all. I try and make every decision in a cognitive, careful, rational, logical thinking manner. So we see these differences. We're not entirely sure what causes that. I think it's to do with this internal bodily sensation, this thing called interoception, which is just internal perception, right? Whether we're hot, cold, hungry, need to go to the bathroom. We have a whole system inside our bodies for perceiving the state. And when it comes to unconscious signals, it's really interesting because our body responds to unconscious information in our brains. When by definition, it's unconscious, we're not aware of it, but our body can tap into that. And that's really what this gut feeling is. Not everyone gets it in the gut. Some people more in the chest. Some people in the fingertips or the palms. I get sweaty palms. But typically it's a bodily response, some physiological response in the body to something the brain is processing that we're not consciously aware of. So you can think about it like that, that it's learning to use your body as a way to tap into this unconscious information. And if that is reliable, if that information is true, then who wouldn't want to have that, right? It's sort of this extra bit of information, this unfair advantage, if you have it, comparing to people that don't have it. So when you sort of describe in that light, it's a pretty desirable thing.
You've also developed a definition to help people think about their own intuition and what it means to have good intuition, right? So what is your definition of intuition?
Let me just preface this by saying not everyone will agree with this definition, right? It can rub a few people the wrong way. So I talk about it as the productive use of unconscious information for better decisions or actions. And then we can also layer in one more word there. So as the learnt productive use. So there's a learning component to it. And I've said decisions and actions, which is kind of important because it includes, you know, bodily movements. So playing sport, playing football, tennis, you name it. So that the body also has access to the unconscious information for making movements. So some people like to think of intuition as almost a magical sixth sense, as tapping into the blueprint of the universe. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm not saying, you know, as a scientist, look, I'm always open and interested to find out new things we don't know about. But I just, for a number of reasons, thought we needed a very practical and science-based definition to foster a whole new field around this.
You've sort of alluded there to this idea that some are sort of skeptical about that definition or about intuition itself. But you and a group of researchers were the first to develop a scientific test to measure intuition. How did you do that?
This started quite a while ago now, probably about at least a decade ago. So my lab had been studying consciousness for quite a while before this. So we had the tools to render things unconscious. And we can do that visually. We can show people pictures. We can put a picture sort of in front of one eye and then show bright flashing lights to the other eye. And because those flashing lights are so bright, it suppresses whatever we show to the other eye. Mm. So that becomes unconscious, but the eye is still processing it. Your brain is still processing it. And I call this emotional inception in the book as a way to sort of give a nod to a Chris Nolan film that I love, Inception. And it is, it's literally that. It's incepting emotional information into the brain, right? We're not doing that by hacking dreams or anything, but we can show people a scary picture like a spider or a snake or a happy picture like a flower or a puppy. And we know their brain's still processing it, even though they'll never be consciously aware of it. They'll never see it. So that's sort of step one, getting that information into the brain. And step two is then tying that with a real time, a real world decision task. And so by doing that, we can monitor and track how well people can combine this unconscious information with a conscious decision, and then how they can learn to do that better and better over time, right? So when we ran all these experiments on intuition, we did that. And we saw really nice data showing that when we're giving people the unconscious emotional information, their brain's responding to it, right? They're sweating more. And in some conditions, we asked people how confident they were. And when we gave them this reliable emotional unconscious information, their confidence went up as well. And again, they didn't know this was going on, right? They don't see the images. It's all happening under the hood. It's all happening unconsciously. So let's go from that task now to an example where, let's say you walk into a cafe or a restaurant, and the second you step into that front door, sometimes we'll get a feeling. It won't be like a strong, heavy feeling like it would be with something very emotional, but you might just kind of go, yeah, maybe not. Let's get coffee, or let's get lunch across the road of that other cafe we saw. And in that sort of 1 second as you walk in, your brain's processing the smells, the colors, the music.
Unconsciously.
All unconsciously. It will take you like 15 minutes to go through logically and go, what do I think of that furniture? What do I think of the hairstyle of that waiter? Or what do I think of this or that? But your brain processes it all very quickly. And because of that prior learning, right, the hundreds or thousands of times you've been to cafes and restaurants, your brain has learned which of these cues predict good coffee or bad coffee or good food or bad food or even food poisoning, right? And so all that learning's already happened, and it's just triggering positive or negative sensations unconsciously that your body's responding to. And then we come back to that gut feeling, that interoception. You feel it almost straight away, and you don't know why you're feeling it, but you do. And so you can take notice of that and go, let's go somewhere else, or you can just ignore it and sort of, you know, get food poisoning or have some bad coffee.
So we've talked a lot about what intuition is, but what are some common misconceptions you come across about what it's actually not? People confusing intuition with other strong emotions or things that actually aren't really helpful.
Yeah, probably the number one is like with anxiety and emotional thinking, what clinicians would call emotional thinking. And it's actually the first rule of the 5 rules I go through in the book. So I have this acronym SMILE. And the S for SMILE, for that first rule, is self-awareness. And that's a reminder to check in with your emotional state, with your stress, your anxiety or depression, because we know those things all mess with intuition. And that's one of the things that, you know, people have a fear of flying. They're about to get on the plane and they're having that strong emotional response. They're often going to confuse that with something like intuition or premonition. I'm feeling this because something's going to happen to the plane. And it's very tempting, right? I've had bouts with anxiety, and the emotional feelings can be very strong. And you start to think, you know, it's so strong, it must be there for a good reason. And that reason must be something to do with things out in the world, not because of me. So that emotional thinking, that stress, anxiety is one I think people will confuse. Another one is anything to do with addictive substances or processes. So that's everything from gambling, social media, checking your email, through to drugs and alcohol and even food, because modern food's highly addictive. The pull, the drag we feel towards these things. I want to check my social media right now. My thumbs are twitching.
I have this impulse.
Yeah, and so you're getting and that's an addictive thing, right? That's a dopamine and other neurotransmitters, other things going on in the brain, and that's not intuition. And we don't want to confuse those things. We definitely don't want to use intuition as an excuse to start gambling or checking their social media or late night snacking or drinking or smoking, right?
But strong emotions can often feel like intuition to us, yeah. Right? So how do we know the difference? Are there physical cues that we can kind of look towards to become more self-aware and distinguish between what is actually intuition and something like anxiety or paranoia?
In the book, I go through sort of developing emotional awareness, which is a part of emotional intelligence, as a first step. So we want to be aware and have good what's called metacognition, which is the way of knowing ourselves, knowing our own thoughts, knowing our own emotions. So we want to get very familiar with labeling emotions. So we become very sensitive to the moment we're starting to feel down or up, stressed or anxious, and just get familiar with those physiological changes. And we want to stop ourselves and get used to asking the question if we are elevated, and it's positive or negative. I should make a point there. It's not always just negative. So if you've just fallen in love and you're on top of the world, or you've just won the lottery, or something really fantastically positive just happened, you probably also shouldn't use intuition.
You're telling me I shouldn't just get married to someone that I've fallen in love with in a cafe that also smells really good?
I would say, no. If you just met someone and you've fallen head over heels in love, fantastic. Don't trust your intuition when you're in that stage, because you're going to be like, everything's going to be, you know, you're going to have rosy glasses on, everything's going to be fantastic. You're going to be skipping and dancing, and that will bias your intuition. That will throw you off. Mm. So you're just going to be careful there. Likewise, stressed, anxious, depressed, or any of those things. Practice being aware of your physiological state, and then have a toolkit to modulate that. I talk about things like box breathing, breathing techniques, and things you can do so very acutely in the moment, right before you need to practice intuition or make an important decision.
It sort of sounds like you're saying these big heightened emotions like love at first sight, or paranoia, or anxiety, or addiction. All of these sorts of things are a little bit more subjective, whereas intuition, or the way you like to think about it, is more objective.
I mean, it's all happening in the brain, right? So all emotional states, mood, anxiety, they're all objectively, we can all measure them objectively and reliably now in the lab. We have a lot of new tech. But so here's a story that I actually talk about in the book, right? So a number of years ago now, quite a while ago, I went on a first date, and it was in Sydney. We went to a rock climbing gym, indoor rock climbing gym. And we're having a fantastic time. We're climbing and falling and, you know, belaying with the ropes and catching each other. And the chemistry was amazing, right? We were falling for each other, just like we're just talking about. It turns out we weren't that well suited for each other. But on that first date, we sort of were like, oh my God, this is like a match made in heaven. It feels fantastic. And it bugged me for years how I got that feeling so wrong. And then one day I realized it was a strong example of what's called arousal misattribution, which is something we actually know a lot about in humans. In other words, when we're aroused, in not just sexually, but in lots any different way, we're pretty lousy at knowing what causes that. So in that example, we're full of adrenaline, we're sweating, we're having a fantastic time climbing and the falling, and our hearts are racing, and we're confusing that it's been caused by the falling, you know, and swinging and banging, you know, the rock climbing, and we're confusing it between the rock climbing and being caused by the other person. Right, and this is a trick that you see in reality TV all the time, and the producers of the Bachelor and Bachelorette will do things like this to increase an arousal state, and then the individual in the show will get confused. They think it's coming from the other person when it's not. It's just coming from something else. So that's a good reason why we should be very careful in any sort of aroused emotional stress state, that we will think it's coming from the thing we're trying to use intuition for, the decision, one of the decision outcomes, and it's not, it's coming from somewhere else. And we'll very easily confuse the two.
We'll be right back.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforming higher education. This message was paid for by EY.
Your research says that we shouldn't always give in to intuition either. So when should we trust our intuition to make really important decisions?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the sort of the through line through all this, through the book, is that we shouldn't, it's not black and white. We should use intuition sometimes, but not other times, and for some things and not other things.
Yep.
So the first rule for S and SMILE is for self-awareness. So we shouldn't use it when we're emotional. The M is for mastery. So we need to have experience with the thing, the area, before we use our intuition. If you've never played chess before, you can't sit down and go, oh, I'm going to be an intuitive chess player. I'm going to feel the moves, right? It's not going to work. You've got to put the hours and time in, or the weeks, months, years, to develop for your brain to learn the links between the patterns on the chessboard and the possible outcomes.
It has to be based on something.
You've got to have that learning. And you can see that in that data from our lab-based experiments. There's a learning part of that process. So you need to be a bit of an expert in the area. How much of an expert, that's a hard thing to really pinpoint. So it's not, you know, the 10,000-hour rules from Malcolm Gladwell is not really a true thing. It's kind of just a sticky idea that stuck with people. So we need to have experience. I in the smile is for impulses and addiction. We talked about addiction a little bit already. Impulses and instincts are a bit different to intuition. A lot of people confuse the two. The instincts are hardwired. L in the smile acronym is for low probabilities. And there's so many examples of this in psychology. A great one is, you know, think about it, it's like the shark attacks, right? It's so safe swimming in the harbor and the ocean. You don't need to worry about sharks, but almost everyone does. And we ignore the probabilities because something's emotional. In other words, don't use intuition for anything around probabilities. And then the E, the final part of smile, and it's E for environment or context. And so the learning is context specific. So what you learn in the workplace won't transfer that well to being at home. So changing the environment changes a lot of things around intuition. So we have to be very careful in different environments using our intuition.
You talk a lot about how intuition is based on this experience and knowledge, but we also know that these things can be really biased, right? By stereotypes, by misconceptions, by misinformation. You know, if I spend a lot of time looking at misinformation about vaccines, for example, is my intuition on health advice going to be wrong?
Yeah, this is a great point. I'm glad we got this in, because when we think about intuition, it's a learning system, unconscious learning system. It's very similar to the way we think about AI systems now. And we've seen how AI can be really biased in a number of ways. But with any of these unconscious learning systems, whatever the training data, whatever data, if junk goes in, junk's going to come out. And it's the same with AI. It's the same with intuition. So if you train your intuition on bad data, then your intuition is going to have biases in it. And examples I talk about in the book are, if you did marathons of old TV or old movies, whether it be, you know, all the classic James Bond stuff, you know, movies, as fun as they are, the way he treats women, for example, is very different to some modern standards. And then lots of films with, you know, with gender, but also race biases in there. And so if you absorb enough of this stuff, you'll start feeling it and you'll start using it. So we just have to be careful about the information we're taking in, where we are, what we're learning from, who we're learning from, right? We have to be aware of that and have to be careful what we're training ourselves on.
Yeah. I mean, it's an important point because I think a lot in popular culture, we often think of, you know, trusting your gut or trusting your intuition as almost like an unknowable truth, like a North Star that's always correct. But it's important to know that it can be wrong as well, right?
Yeah, there's so many forces that drive us as humans, and we're only aware of some of them. And this is fascinating, and it applies to so many parts of life, to your personal happiness, to, you know, in advertising, we're manipulated by ads, we're manipulated by the way supermarkets put things on the shelves. All these subtle things bias us, nudge us, right? And cognitive bias nudges is a huge thing on websites, right? This a small little nudge by putting your options for your insurance or whatever it might be, health cover or something, in this order instead of this order, applied to millions of people, makes a massive difference. So we are vulnerable to all kinds of influences. Some of those are unconscious, some of those are from learning, some of those are just from the way our brain is wired up. And that's what a cognitive bias is, right? It's like a visual optical illusion. And these illusions, these optical illusions, they apply to memory, they apply to thinking, they apply to every level of thinking, really. So, you know, I could say as a cognitive neuroscientist, that's job security, right? There's so many fascinating things to study and apply to the world to make people's lives better. But yeah, you're absolutely right. We are vulnerable to a lot of strange and unusual influences.
And when it comes to sort of the accuracy or the effectiveness of intuition, of using it right, have you studied how gender and cultural differences come into play?
We haven't had a chance to really unpack that with our objective measurements in the lab. There's interesting questionnaire data on that. And when you give people of different cultures and different genders and sexes, these questionnaires, women will generally report using intuition a lot more than men. What they tend to do in these studies is, along with the intuition questionnaires, they give a whole range of other emotionality questionnaires, what's called magical thinking, which is a bit like superstition. And women will score higher on both those dimensions in terms of, generally speaking, will be tend to be report being more emotional, report more magical thinking, which is a bit like superstition across the board, except for when it comes to sports and betting. Then all of a sudden, everything switches and men report all this crazy superstitious thinking. You're right, you got to do this and cross your fingers and cross your legs. And so that is general ways of thinking. Again, if that maps onto actual better or more intuition and the way the brain works, we don't know the answer to that yet, unfortunately.
Okay. Fascinating. There's so much to find out. I mean, what is next for your work on intuition? What else are you hoping to uncover?
Well, we want to keep doing research. We want to understand the interoception part of that. Why are these individual differences? So both working for the fundamental research side of things, but also the application. So I'm a big fan, and really I'm on a mission now as my career develops and I get older, to try and turn all that information we have that's all, you know, so often locked behind closed doors in academia and these papers that are published in journals that you got to pay to get access to, turn all that into practical protocols and guides that people can use to link their emotions and their decision-making. In other words, to bring intuition to the forefront and also build that science around there. So I talk to people in sport and leadership CEOs of companies who say, absolutely, of course I use intuition. I have to. And I say, well, do you talk about that publicly? Can I mention who you are and that you use it? And they say, oh, no, please don't. No. I don't want anyone to know. So it still has a bit of tabooiness around it because it has this alternative thing that it's a spiritual thing or that it's a blueprint of the sixth sense. And even though people in business are using intuition and they're going to be using it more and more as the world becomes more uncertain and changes more rapidly, we need to build that science around there so it is legitimate, build the science around that so we do understand it. We know there's nothing embarrassing by any, from the prime minister, president, through to the CEOs, the sports teams, through to new parents, right? Everyone can talk about intuition, understand, optimize it, follow the rules so it's an open topic of discussion. Often what happens is people won't pay much attention to intuition and then until they've got like a life or death situation or a divorce, get married, buy or sell a house, move country, these big decisions where they start feeling emotion and then all of a sudden this gut response becomes like a big deal.
Yeah.
But often I think, you know, you want to actually start practicing that over and over before then with the small things in life, the cafes, the restaurants, the this or that. So practice that on small things first, then build up and build up. So when it does come to these big decisions with a lot riding on them, you're fully aware of that first rule, that S rule. And so you know if you're, you know if you're thinking too emotionally, you're stressed or anxious, you can stop, do an exercise to bring yourself back down to baseline, then go back to intuition.
On a micro scale, if say one person is, you know, reading your book and doing all the practice and getting it right, so to speak, what difference do you hope that that will make to their lives?
I mean, improvement of the quality of their life, right? They will make better decisions.
Mm.
And because of that, the quality of their life should improve. People often have a mismatch or a disconnect between feelings and decisions, and to bring those together for everyone in ways that are practical. We can all get access to this extra well of information in our brains, right? So there's this metaphor that we use in neuroscience that we're only aware of the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the information in our brains.
Mm.
So the majority of that is unconscious. So your brain's processing everything in the room right now. And most of it, you're all blocking out. You're paying attention to this narrow thing. You listen to my voice. We're only really conscious of this tiny little, you know, pinprick of amount of information compared to the vast amount that is your brain is actually processing. So the idea is to get more and more access to more and more information, therefore make better decisions.
That was Professor Joel Pearson. He's a cognitive neuroscientist at UNSW and the author of The Intuition Toolkit, published by Simon & Schuster. Science writer Bianca Nogrady also wrote about Joel's work on intuition for Guardian Australia. We'll post a link to her article on the Full Story page. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Alison Chan. Sound design and mixing was by Camilla Hannon. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. And if you like this episode, don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also leave us a review. I'm Jane Lee. Catch you next time.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.